If you wanted organic food in the early 1970s, you were likely to find it in dingy stores with bins of bulk grain and maybe some limp produce delivered by battered VW microbuses. Today, Mercedes and Mini Coopers fight for space outside Whole Foods, where customers are happy to pay $11 for a quart of organic pomegranate juice. Our next guest spent two decades in the health food business, which grew from a handful of stores run by hippie entrepreneurs who wanted to share their lifestyles, into a major force in American agriculture and food retailing. Sales now total $100 billion a year. Marketing professional Joe Dobrow profiles the visionaries who made this happen and a changing American culture that began to take nutrition seriously. First, the news. And welcome to our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. About the same time baby boomers began to question the moral authority of government, religion, and just about every other American institution, a quieter but still important revolution was shaking America's dining room tables. Alarm bells were ringing about pesticides and other chemicals that had been pouring into America's food supply ever since the nation's chemical and agricultural industries had switched from wartime to peacetime production. In a back-to-the-land movement, a handful of 60s idealists moved onto farms to produce healthy food raised without pesticides or artificial fertilizers. A handful of those began to sell that food to like-minded friends and neighbors. And according to our next guest, they sowed the seeds of a health food industry whose sales now total $100 billion a year. Joe Dobrow spent 20 years in that industry, including 7 as national marketing director for its retailing leader, Whole Foods Markets. In a new book, Joe traces the business from its hippie days through the 1980s and 1990s, when an ambitious group of opportunists with roots in environmentalism and idealism, but better heads for business, turned the health food industry into what he calls a bubbling crucible of mission-driven entrepreneurial activity. In the process, the author profiles a fascinating collection of characters who may be less well-known than the heroes of Silicon Valley, but who, he argues, were as influential in transforming the way we live and work. They include John Mackey, founder of the Whole Foods chain, which now owns some 370 stores. Then the man who milked the first organically fed cows that produced Stonyfield Farm yogurt. And the man who parlayed a small chain of California convenience stores into Trader Joe's, with more than 400 outlets across the country. As the public bought into the health food retailer's message, or at least a small but well-heeled segment of the public bought into it, big food and big agriculture took notice. Giant retailers such as Kroger and Walmart, along with smaller regional grocers, began stocking organic produce and dairy products, and most now have extensive natural food sections and their own house brands. Meanwhile, the nation's largest brands, including Coca-Cola, Kraft, Nabisco, Dannon, and others, have either introduced their own organic products or taken the easy way out, buying the original organic food companies outright and making their owners millionaires. Even so, organic and natural foods account for only 5% of the American market still, and that's largely at the upscale end of it. Can the industry continue its double-digit growth if a wider class of consumers does not buy in? We'll ask Joe Dobrow, a longtime industry player and consultant whose new book is Natural Profits, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S. It could have been the other one, right? From health foods to Whole Foods, how the pioneers of the industry changed the way we eat and reshaped American business. It's available from Rodale Books. So Joe Dobrow, welcome back to Baltimore. How you doing?
Well, thank you, Dan. Good afternoon. It is an honor to be with you, and it's a pleasure to be talking to my fellow Marylanders.
Well, let's tell folks about your connections here. I know you've lived in Montgomery County off and on for quite a while, but you were up here in Baltimore in the 90s when a store called Fresh Fields opened in Mount Washington.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people remember that because it was really quite an event. It was in 1996, and Fresh Fields, which was based in Rockville, had been growing like a weed. It was up to 20, 25 stores, about $250 million. And it had grown like nothing the natural foods industry had ever seen. And we had some trepidation about opening in Baltimore. You know, there were lots of little natural food stores that had been around there forever. You know, you had the OK Natural Food Store near the Meyerhof, and you had the Health Concern in Towson, and, you know, just a lot of little places like that. But there was nothing to guarantee that Freshfields was going to take off in Baltimore in the way that it had been in D.C. and Philadelphia and Chicago. And on top of that, we had this site on Smith Avenue, you know, in Mount Washington, that's a little bit inaccessible. But when that store opened in 1996, it was the best opening that Freshfields had ever done. And as I talk about pretty extensively in Natural Profits, that was the time period during which Freshfields was actually behind the scenes in negotiations to sell the company to Whole Foods. So on the one hand, you had this great success in Baltimore. And on the other hand, it was almost over.
It didn't last long. So how long did it last? Because, you know, until I went back to your book, I had to refresh my memory about all of that. I had almost forgotten the Freshfields brand.
It's amazing the way we do forget about these things. And, you know, you think about some of the retailers in the National Capital Area who were all big and important at that point. You know, you had Heckinger's and you had Heckinger's. Woody's. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, one after another, Crown Books. I mean, they're all gone. And Freshfields is gone, too, although the stores still remain. They're just called Whole Foods today.
Right.
So, yeah, Whole Foods was really blazing a trail that was unlike anything that had been seen, not just in the natural foods industry, but really in U.S. commerce, because it had grown up from a single store in 1980 in Austin, Texas, with not an awful lot of plans to world hegemony. They thought themselves to be a regional player, just like Bread and Circus did in Boston or Mrs. Gooch's did in L.A. But when Freshfields had come on the scene in 1991, it was different. You know, this had been created by a team of people who had come out of Harvard Business School, and Mark Ordan was from Goldman Sachs. So they came in with $14 million of money, some of that coming from T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. And they came in with this Harvard management acumen and a goal that they were going to grow this into a big enterprise. It was very opportunistic. It was very clever. It was very smart. And so when Whole Foods felt threatened by this point they had bought most of the other retailers out there, a real war erupted, and you know, people in the D.C. area and the Baltimore area really loved the Freshfields name and brand and were a little bit resistant when Whole Foods started to come in and when that deal went through in 1996, even to the extent that we ended up keeping the Freshfields name on the outside of the stores, I think, for another 4 years after that merger was done.
Well, let's talk about John Mackey. He's the survivor. Whole Foods is the survivor. He's the CEO. And so I think that's a good place to start if we tell his story and the story of Whole Foods. So first of all, who is John Mackey?
He's one of the most remarkable people I've ever met in my life. And I think I hope I've done him justice with the very colorful profile that I've written about him in Natural Profits. John was born in Houston, was a very competitive kid. In fact, when he was in high school, he got cut from his varsity basketball team, and so he persuaded his parents to move to the next town so that he would be able to try out for a different team, and ended up making that. You know, if you could project that sort of attitude forward, that's exactly what he brought into the business world. But it took a while. So, you know, he was a shaggy-haired guy. He got into vegetarianism. He got into natural foods. He moved to Austin. He dropped out of college several times. And little by little, he started to really become a part of this movement. And in 1978, he opened up a natural food store of his own, which he called Safer Way. And so that was sort of his stick-it-to-the-man way of of giving it to what was then the country's largest grocer. And he ran that for a couple of years, but at that point he saw some competition coming into the market. And so he went to them with a move that I describe in the book as being one part, pure logic and one part Don Corleone. And essentially he said to them, look, I've got a new site. It's twice the size of your store. So you can either join me or you can compete against me. And they did end up deciding to join him, and they opened in 1980 this store that they called Whole Foods Market. And that was, by the way, precisely the strategy that John used many, many times later to persuade and pressure competition into becoming part of the Whole Foods empire, which is now, believe it or not, number 232 on the Fortune 500 list. So, yeah, this was the way that Whole Foods grew up originally. And, you know, John was always a very different thinker. Very analytical, extremely well-read. Didn't matter that he didn't have that college degree. I mean, he grew up in the school of hard commercial knocks. So Whole Foods grew slowly at first. A couple more stores in Austin. They expanded out into Houston. They bought a little store in Dallas. And John was one of a group of people around the country who would get together periodically, and they would actually share information. You know, they exchanged P&Ls back and forth and HR information in a communal way that's impossible to imagine any industry engaging in today. But that was a different era.
A different era. Well, I even want to step back a little bit further, even before the full Whole Foods story now, to understand why John Mackey, how he could see this coming. I mean, what was going on? There were a lot of other things going on, because in the 60s and 70s, I remember when I first started hearing the term organic food, what did that mean? That meant some guy with a mustache and bushy hair and his girlfriend and maybe a VW microbus, maybe an El Camino.
Oh, definitely.
Or an El Camino,
definitely the
maybe.
VW microbus.
Okay, yeah, you know, growing some food without pesticides and planting marigolds so that there would be a lot of bees around and other insects that were good for the plants. And yeah, this was a very limited thing. In fact, I think you say in your book, you mentioned that in the early 1970s, all of the food cooperatives in the Washington area put together had a fraction of the sales of one Safeway store.
That's
so
right.
So take your time here, Joe. Let's talk a little bit about how this happened, what Mackey saw coming, what was happening, and what were all the factors that led to this opportunity?
All right, so let's go all the way back then.
How far back you want to go?
let's go back to our grandparents' era, right? So if today you could somehow summon up a photograph of your grandmother's icebox or your grandmother's pantry, virtually everything that you would see in there was what today we would call natural and organic. Now, you wouldn't have known it because there were no labeling laws, right? So there, you couldn't look on the side of the package necessarily to see what was in it. But the reality was that the chemical revolution hadn't happened yet. And so all of those products, whether it was, you know, Welch's or Postum or Grape Nuts or things like that, they all came more or less straight from nature because there were no chemicals in the equation. There wasn't even an equation. This is what natural and organic was back in that era. And then, as you mentioned in your opening, which, by the way, was extremely well done, in the years right after World War II, this changed very, very quickly. And what happened was that the capacity for war material that had built up during the war and a lot of the patents from German companies which came over to the West all started to coalesce, and DDT was released for public use in 1945. And this was a miraculous pesticide. It was great for farmers. It was great for home use. It was so potent that they boasted that it could kill a fly even with a 60-day-old application on a barn door. Well, what they didn't take into account as they were developing all of these different chemical compounds was that Mother Nature always has a little trick up her sleeve, and it's called evolution. And so just 4 years after DDT was released, in 1949, more than 80% of flies had already built up an immunity to it. So forget about that 60-day-old application on the barn door. They were just ignoring it at that point. So all these chemical compounds come into use. They're repurposed for agriculture. And all of a sudden, we've got these sweeteners and these emulsifiers and artificial additives and colors and preservatives. And Madison Avenue gets into the act, and they start creating all these catchy jingles for Mounds bars and Coca-Cola and one consumer product after another. And still we have no labeling laws at this point, so consumers really don't know what's in their products. They just know that they taste better, and that they're more accessible and that they're much more affordable than they ever were before. And so all of this is a good thing. But what's happening behind the scenes is that this whole new industry of food science is beginning to explode. And I tell the story in the book a little bit about this product that was called Merlinex, that was created by a company with the almost scary sounding name of International Multifoods. And Merlinex was advertised as instant anything. In fact, one writer, Jim Hightower, referred to it as the silly putty of the food world. So it became fig paste. It became imitation strawberry filling and pastries. It was brownies. It was Colby cheese. It was whatever you needed it to be. But consumers were not aware of this because, again, this was sort of all happening behind the scenes. So that's the world into which many of us were born, and John Mackey and a lot of these other natural prophets that I've written about in the book were part of that generation. And so, again, as you indicated in your opening piece, you know, when these guys went through the 60s and the convulsions of that decade, and they started to reject big business, reject government, reject religion, reject all these other institutions, and then they started to go into the business world for themselves, oh my gosh, they looked around. They saw that the world of their grandparents' food had been completely changed, completely convoluted, and they decided that they were going to try to take it back.
And they had read Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, too.
The most influential book of its era, unquestionably. Came out in 1962, and in really beautiful but also graphic language, it told the story of pesticides, and in particular of DDT. Rachel Carson talked about how it was affecting ecosystems and how it was killing puppies and how the orange grove workers in Riverside, California were in a retching half-blind misery after they were exposed to it. And again, keep in mind, you know, the American public at this point, blissfully unaware of all this, they're not being told these stories by Douglas Edwards on CBS News. Now, all of a sudden, out comes this book. It makes the New York Times bestseller list. And it's starting to get scary out there because for the first time, people are beginning to question whether their food is safe.
Joe, let's stop there and we'll pick up our conversation at that point in the history of the natural food movement. Joe Dobrow is with us. Natural Profits is the name of his book, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. It chronicles the growth of the natural foods industry from a handful of dingy macrobiotic food stores run by a collection of aging hippies to the gleaming palaces of Whole Foods and ever-growing organic food sections of conventional supermarkets. 410-662-8780 is our number. A short break on midday. Joe Dobrow is our guest. He worked in marketing for retailers, natural food retailers in the U.S., including Whole Foods, Fresh Fields, which we talked about, Sprouts Farmers Market as well. His book is Natural Profits. It's published by Rodale. So, okay, we did the back history there a little bit, Joe, and then you were telling us about John Mackey and how Whole Foods got rolling. I think it would be enlightening and entertaining for our listeners here for me to mention some of the other figures at that time who were involved in all this. So if I throw some names at you, you can tell us where they stand in this history of the natural food movement.
Let's do that.
Okay. Let's start with, we mentioned John Mackey. How about Gary Hirschfield? Gary Hirschfield, who milked the first organically fed cows that produced Stonyfield Farm yogurt.
Yeah, so it's actually Gary Hirschberg.
Oh, Hirschberg, but, sorry, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Gary's probably not listening today. Gary today is one of the most influential figures in the industry. And actually, he is in Washington a lot on Capitol Hill because he's a proponent for labeling of genetically modified ingredients and fighting climate change and all sorts of other causes. But all of that grew up because he had the gumption to go milk some organic cows. Mm-hmm. This was a very well-educated guy, grew up in New Hampshire. He came upon this organization which had just started called Stonyfield Farm, and it was founded by a guy named Samuel Kamen, who had this great old yogurt recipe from some Hasidic Jews that he knew in Brooklyn. And they decided that this would be a very good business for them to be able to raise some money for an organic school that they were trying to get going in New Hampshire. And then all of a sudden they realized that they had things backwards there and that the yogurt was the better business of the two. And so they worked at this thing tooth and nail. And really, I mean, it's a seminal story of entrepreneurship, because it was just them and their families and, you know, maybe a handful of employees for quite a while. And they would do everything. So they would get up in the morning, they'd go milk the cows, they would negotiate all the deals to buy the containers, they would talk to the retailers. And then after they had had a long day of all of this, and in Gary's case, that often involved surreptitiously asking his mother-in-law for loans, then they would go off to the Stop and Shop stores at night and they would demo the product there, because nobody knew the name Stonyfield. Nobody really understood what was different about that from Columbo or Dannon or the other major brands of the day. And this went on for years and years. In fact, Stonyfield went 9 years before they finally turned a profit. And when Gary looks back on that, he describes what he calls the hopeless, infinite naivete about cash flow that has characterized the entrepreneurs in this industry.
You know, one person that doesn't seem to fit the old hippie mold was this California woman, Sandy Gooch. What was her story?
That's true. Sandy was kind of a member of the establishment, if you will. So she was a school teacher in the 1960s and 1970s, very successful. She became a master teacher out there. But like a lot of people, she was drawn into the industry because of a personal crisis. And in her case, it was that she had developed an eye infection, and they were treating it with tetracycline. And she had a very bad and adverse reaction to it. And so she was hospitalized. And while she was in the hospital and they were trying to figure out what was going wrong, she had a sip of some soda. And there was a chemical agent in the soda that reacted with the tetracycline, and it almost caused her to die. And the medical establishment could not figure out what was going on. And this went on for quite a while. Her father was in the biomedical business, was not a physician, but was in the biomedical business. And he was a dogged and determined guy. And he finally figured out that this is what had happened, this interaction. And he suggested that the way to heal Sandy was for her to change her diet and to eliminate all the chemicals from her diet. And so when she was released from Scripps, she ended up just driving up and down the California coast from Santa Barbara to San Diego, seeking out these tiny little health food stores, you know, the California equivalents of Beautiful Day health food store in College Park, and buying brown rice and tofu and azuki beans and all of these chemical-free things. And yeah, the produce was ugly and it didn't taste very good, because the art and the science of organic agriculture really had not come into being at that point. And so Sandy did this for a little while, but then she finally realized, this is crazy. I'm losing energy just driving up and down the coast here. Why don't I start my own store? And that's what she did. And in the late 70s, the first Mrs. Gooch's Natural Market opened up in West L.A., and it was a smash success. And so before that first year was out, she opened another store in Hermosa Beach. And Mrs. Gooch's quickly grew into what was the most important natural foods chain of the era, from 1978 up until the early 1990s, when eventually they were bought by Whole Foods.
At this point, I want to ask you a question about natural foods and the market, the consumer. In that story you were just reciting, it seems to me that she was a smash success almost from the beginning. People in L.A., you know, just accepted that what she was selling was the real thing, right? Natural food, organic food. I mean, it might have been at first seen as a fad of some kind, but obviously it remains with us because so many other things are happening culturally in America during this period anyway. But there is a sort of a leap of faith, is there not, in all of this, until the government standards come in to organic food, for instance? There's a leap of faith that what you're getting is what they say it is, natural, organic.
That is absolutely correct. And Sandy Gooch is actually a really good example of this, because in the era in which he got her business going, there was no federal definition of organic. There was then, as today, no federal definition of what is natural. And so Sandy defined it. She became the most influential retailer because she set created a set of product standards saying we're not going to carry any caffeinated products, we're not going to carry any bleached or bromated flour or any white sugar or any irradiated foods, and on and on. And she was very smart, and she researched all of these things. And there was a saying in the industry back in the day, if you had a product and you wanted to try to get it into the health food stores, is it Goochable? You know, would it meet Sandy's high standards?
Huh.
And it's an important point, because today, when you look at the GMO issue, at genetic modification, again, we have no federal standard. Individual states are acting on their own, or at least trying to. And so into the void steps Whole Foods. And they say, with a statement that they came out with last year, that within the next couple of years, they are going to require that any food sold in their stores be labeled if it has genetically modified ingredients. And so they're sort of using the power of the retailer to create a standard and to create that confidence level for consumers in the absence of any federal action on it.
We're speaking with Joe Dobrow, D-O-B-R-O-W. His book, Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. One more character I want to ask you about from these stories. Actually, there's many I could ask you about. But Mo Siegel. I was interested in Mo Siegel. First of all, I love the name Mo Siegel. He sounds like he was in the, you know, with Don Corleone or something. But anyway, this Mo Siegel, there's a beautiful picture of Mo Siegel from the 1970s on your website for Natural Profits, naturalprofits.com. I don't know where he is, but he's out picking herbs in some beautiful place with a mountain in the background for Celestial Seasonings. And this is sometime in the early 1970s. Let's talk about Mo. I was a little surprised to see this here, because I don't know why. I just don't associate Celestial Seasonings with organic or natural. But I guess it is. I guess it's in that pantheon.
It's in that pantheon. It's not organic, but it is natural. It is really the most important early natural foods company, because it got to scale before anybody else did. And in some ways, that was just an accidental thing. Hmm. So here comes this guy, Mo Siegel. He's born in the years after World War II, and he grows up as a child of the 60s. He tries college for a little while, but doesn't really stick with it. Moves up into the mountains in Colorado, and he is selling posters at a little health food store called Mother's. And in his off time, he goes out into the... Isn't it?
Yeah, perfect. It's perfect, yeah.
So he goes off into the mountains. He's picking a lot of herbs, and he brews tea out of these things. And he finds that it's really good tea. And so he thinks, hey, maybe there's a business in this. So he gives all his posters away to Mother, and he goes to Boulder, and he sets up shop in an old A-frame that somebody gave him for this company that he calls Celestial Seasonings. Now, it's 1969. The guy has no money. He has no access to capital. He has no blueprint. He has no business experience. There's no model out there for any company to create an herbal tea business. The only things that we have anything like that are the Liptons and Bigelows and Tetleys of the world, which are these mass-produced black teas. And so he starts hacking his way through the wilderness, trying to figure out how to do this. And I tell a story in the book about how he goes to try to get a $25,000 loan from a local bank, and he walks in there with his partner, and they kind of do this dog and pony show in this glass office of the manager, and at the end of it, they walk out, they look back, and the manager and all of his colleagues are just doubled over in laughter.
You want to sell what? You want what?
You're going to make this $100 million business out of tea leaves? Are you kidding? And there's fantastic story about Mo that in 2 years into this, in 1971, he's taking a road trip from Colorado to New York. He stops off in Chicago. He ends up at a dinner party with all of these executives from General Foods. And the CEO of General Foods is there, a guy named C.W. Cook. And so Mo starts talking to him, and he says, hey, you know, I've started this tea company. We're creating herbal teas. It's called Celestial Seasonings. And so this guy is sort of a little bit amused, and He tells Mo Siegel that, well, we have many beverages at General Foods, including Tang, a chemical version of orange juice that went up into space with John Glenn. And this C.W. Cook just starts rhapsodizing about the chemical revolution and how soon all foods will be made in the laboratory. And Mo Siegel is just gradually reaching his boiling point, and he lashes out at this guy and he says, you keep talking like that and the natural foods industry is going to explode. And C.W. Cook says back to him, why don't you give up your goofy little tea company and come work for me? But Mo didn't, and he stuck with it. He used that incident as motivation and eventually did build it into his $100 million company. And today, it's known as Hain Celestial, and it is the largest manufacturer of natural foods in the world.
Does Kraft own Celestial Seasonings now?
No. Hain Celestial is a publicly traded company.
Hain Celestial. Okay.
Yeah, so Kraft did buy it at one point, but eventually sold it back.
Okay, because when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about where these companies have gone over time. You know, Kellogg owns Kashi, I think. Is that right?
Right.
Cascadian Farms is mentioned in your book. Welch's grape juice people bought out Cascadian. And the Dannon Empire now owns Stonyfield Farms yogurt. So there is that trend. And then there's the trend of natural foods, organic foods coming into the other supermarkets, the other marketplaces too. So we'll talk all about that when we get back with Joe Dobrow after another short break here on Midday. His book, Natural Profits. A short break. We'll be right back. Our guest in this hour of Midday has profiled the visionaries who grew health food into a $100 billion industry. Joe Dobrow spent two decades in the business working in marketing for, among others, Whole Foods. He's written a book about some of these folks, including the founder of Whole Foods. The book is called Natural Profits from Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. So speaking of business, let's talk about the business today. I mentioned how some of these companies have been bought out by much larger food companies. We have the founders of Honest Tea on the show. They started their company just down the road in Bethesda. They're now owned by Coca-Cola. So, you know, given the track record of these companies, can consumers trust them to deliver the same kind of natural and healthy products that they thought they were getting from the beginning, that they demand?
Yeah, so again, let's just go back in time a little bit. It was 30 years ago last week that we had one of the first important sales of a natural foods company to a big food company. And that was when, as you had mentioned, Celestial Seasonings was sold to Kraft. I think it was March 21st of 1984. And it took a little while, but eventually the big food companies and the big retail food companies started to pay attention. In fact, there's a great story that I tell in the book about Freshfields, that after Freshfields got going with the stores in Rockville and Bethesda and Tyson's Corner and was starting to really make a difference, there was a board meeting going on at Giant. And Izzy Cohn, who was the chairman then and son of the founder, said to the board members, thinking about Freshfields, should we crush them? And the answer was, no, they were too unimportant. They were just a speck and they would let them live. You know, Giant perhaps could have done something about it had they decided to make a commitment to natural and organic foods at the time, or to dip heavily into their budget and market against Freshfields, which really didn't have the money to be able to do anything like that. But they didn't. So you started to see this trend with big food companies looking at the natural foods companies, seeing them succeed, and then buying them. And in the period after 1996, it really began to accelerate. So that was when Heinz bought Earth's Best Baby Food, and M&M Mars bought Seeds of Change, and Dean Foods got into the game, and they eventually bought White Wave, and then Horizon, and on and on and on. And today, if you go out on the internet and search, there's an incredible chart that was created by a guy named Phil Howard out at Michigan State, that it's an infographic that shows who owns whom. And virtually all of the big natural foods companies, the brands that you would find if you go into that Whole Foods in Mount Washington that we were talking about before, are owned by the big conventional food companies out there. you ask, is it a bad thing? Can we trust them? And what I would answer is, I think it's actually a good thing. And here's why. Because in those early days, they were buying into those companies because they were trying to eliminate a competitor. So there's a wonderful story also in Natural Profits about how when Kraft did buy Celestial Seasonings, they bought a brand, but they really didn't know what they were getting. And so one of the brand managers there, a fellow named Terry Tierney, reported to me that at Kraft, there's sort of this big leather-bound book that tells the Kraft story for brand managers. And on page one, it goes all through the history of Kraft General Foods and talks about how you build a brand and how you create value and what the magic formula is. And on page two, it basically says, don't screw it up. And that was their approach. So it was really a transactional thing back then. It was about money. But today, it really isn't, because I think what's happened is that as the natural foods industry has succeeded and has grown from these hippie outposts into this $100 billion industry, projected to be well over $200 billion before the end of the decade, perhaps amounting to 10 to 12% of all the dollars spent on food, it has begun to influence the big food companies. And many of them have gone back and cleaned up some of their formulations. They've started to realize that the consumers have changed, that they are interested in transparency, that they do care about the so-called triple bottom line, with a focus not just on profits, but on the environment and on people as well. And so in the case of a Stonyfield Farm or an Honest Tea, both of whom have been bought by big food companies, in the former case, it's Groupe Danone, which owns Danone, and in the latter, it's Coca-Cola. But in both of those cases, it's really not a matter of selling out. It's a matter of buying in, because these brands have been left whole. They've retained their integrity. The founders and CEOs, Seth Goldman of Honest Tea, still runs Honest Tea. And little by little, in my opinion, is starting to influence his parent company, Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And we start to see this kind of reverse DNA model taking hold.
You also make this interesting point about the, and you just did again, about the large supermarket chains packaging house brands of some organic products. And this was interesting to me, Joe. Kroger may now be the largest retailer of natural foods in the country.
Well, right? Number two, for sure. Yeah. Huh. So in the Baltimore, Washington area now, they own Harris Teeter. And in most of the rest of the country, Kroger is really a dominant player under many different banners. So they, at the beginning of 2012, introduced this natural and organic private label line that they called The Simple Truth. And it didn't exist before then. They had a lot of little other lines instead. But they rolled them all up into The Simple Truth at the beginning of 2012. At the end of 2012... Simple Truth is already a billion-dollar brand in 1 year. And at the end of 2013, the CEO of Kroger came out and said that if you could somehow take out all of the natural and organic food sales that were now happening in the Kroger company and create an independent company out of those, it would easily be the second largest natural foods retailer in the United States. So you kind of do a little interpolation there, and Whole Foods is at about $11 or $12 billion as the number one player, and Sprouts Farmers Market, mostly out west, is the number two at about $2.5 or $3 billion. So, you know, it's likely that Kroger is doing maybe $6, $7, $8 billion in natural food sales right now, which is an amazing thing.
You know, some people refer to Whole Foods as Whole Paycheck, and I mentioned in the beginning of the show here how. This is like 5%, not just Whole Foods, but the whole market, when you look at it, is about 5% of the consumer market for food in the United States still.
Right.
So, and it's a pretty high-end demographic, relatively speaking, that goes to that store and these others. So my question for you then, looking forward, is how does this industry continue? Can it continue that way? You know, having this sort of double-digit growth that we're seeing from year to year without appealing to a wider class of consumers, or getting them to buy in, or do you think that's going to happen with time, and will we see prices come down?
I think it already is happening. The analogy that I would give you is that if Whole Foods is BMW, sure, it's not affordable by everybody. But BMW has been enormously influential in engineering and in helping other car companies to sort of up the ante. in terms of the quality of what they do. And even if Whole Foods never grows beyond its current market share, you mentioned they've got 370 stores. There's some areas like Baltimore, Washington, where they've got a bunch of stores and they do very well. But even if they don't grow much beyond that, nevertheless, I think the influence that they are having is very important, because without them, you would not be able to go into Giant today and see all of those natural and organic foods there. They were never there before. And so what we're seeing is that there's this democratization that's been going on now for a few years in the natural and organic foods industry. And if Whole Foods is significantly more expensive for some, and there's no question that in some departments it is, although I think personally, I think the whole paycheck thing is a little bit overblown. But nevertheless, their influence and their success has brought those same brands and those same foods into Giant, into Safeway, into Shoppers Food Warehouse, into Weis Markets. And so as a result, the manufacturers now have a lot more business, and they're able to do larger production runs, and they're able to start bringing their production costs down, and that's bringing the retail costs down. Hmm. So it's like any industry, once it's commoditized, you start to get these economies of scale that are good for everybody.
Hmm. And down at the bottom, on the ground, we see expansion of farmers markets, of the local food movement that we've talked about a lot on this show, because that seems to continue as well. You know, food to the table, farm to fork, at another level.
Yeah, if you put your ear to the ground, there's a lot of noise coming from that movement. And it's still small, but I wouldn't underestimate it, because in the same way that people underestimated the natural and organic food industry 20 and 30 years ago, you know, we could be making that mistake today. I will say this about the local food movement. Because it is local, inherently, I think there are some limits on how much it can grow or how much we want it to grow. A great story for you is that when I was running marketing for Sprouts, we opened a store in the suburbs of Sacramento called Roseville. And within perhaps 50 miles of that store, there are lots of farms and lots of crops and products that we were buying from those farms. So they were certainly local. But the problem is there's no system and there's no economies of scale out there that would allow those individual farmers to sell directly to that store, because the store would end up having to deal with hundreds and hundreds of different vendors, and the farmers would have to be going to dozens of different stores, and everybody would be busy doing that instead of doing what they're very good at. And so instead, what ends up happening is that those farmers sell to brokers, and the brokers ship those products and those crops down to Los Angeles, where Sprouts buys them and ships them right back up to Sacramento. So local?
Yeah.
Yes. Carbon footprint? No.
No, not so great. Yeah. Hey, Joe, would you do me and my listeners a favor here? We've been using the words organic and natural all through this show. Perhaps we should have started with this, but we didn't. But I want you to take a minute here, and for those of us who go shopping and see that word organic, and then we see the word natural, make the distinction for us. And then the last part of that is to go back to an earlier question I had. How much do you trust it? I mean, I know you worked in this industry. Maybe you're a little biased. You know the folks, so you tend to trust them. But, you know, consumers, some of us are still leery of these claims, especially especially when you see store brands and you wonder, are they just trying to get on the bandwagon by labeling something a certain way?
So first of all, great.
Yeah, go with the definition and then tell us how much you trust it. So organic versus natural.
Right. So interestingly, if you were to poll people today, many people think that natural is a higher standard. But in fact, it isn't. You go back 30 years now, lots of different states were enacting their own organic laws. And you could go into one of those health food stores like the Health Concern or OK Natural Foods that I talked about before. And on the shelf, right next to each other, you'd see products that said that they were Pennsylvania organic, or they were Colorado organic, or they were California organic. And it all meant slightly different things because the states had different definitions for it. In 1990, the federal government passed the Organic Foods Production Act, which was to give rise to a federal definition of organic and clean up that mess. And that was eventually fully enacted in 2002, although they continue to tweak it a little bit here and there. But from that point forward, when you saw that USDA organic seal out there, you could know with confidence that that product had been produced according to a single standard. And you can argue whether it's the very best standard, could it be stricter, but, you know, it's the best that we've got, and I think it's a very good standard, quite honestly. Now, natural has really never had that federal definition. And so there are certainly examples of companies out there that make liberal use of it, some of which are being sued because they've made too liberal use of it. Crystal Light is one example of that, where they always refer to it as natural lemonade flavor or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of stuff in it that you really couldn't even pronounce. But the good news is that within the industry, there generally has been an accepted definition of natural, which has come to mean that it is minimally processed and it's made without artificial flavors, preservatives, additives, and colorings. So it's not as high a standard as organic. Organic, by the way, also precludes the use of any genetically modified ingredients, whereas natural does not. So there are two different standards out there. My hope and my expectation is that at some point, hopefully in the near future, we will see some action on the definition of natural and be able to restore that confidence to consumers that when they see that all-natural claim out there, that it actually means something, and it means the same thing everywhere. Hmm. Now, you asked, should we trust the brands, particularly those store brands, when we see them, or are they just jumping on the natural foods bandwagon? And I would also agree with you that, sure, I am biased because I've had lots of opportunity to meet the people who are growing and producing these foods. And what I believe, really at the bottom of my heart, is that the people who are in this industry are in it for a reason that's bigger than profits. I've never encountered an industry that has quite this mission focus. And I've actually, you know, despite 20 years in the natural foods industry, you know, I ran the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation for Cal and Billy for a while. I worked for Discovery Channel. I've, you know, done a number of other things, but I've never seen an industry like the natural and organic foods one that has such integrity and such passion and such such a mission focus. So a great little story about that is Gene Kahn. I talk about him in the book quite a bit. He was the founder of Cascadian Farm, one of the great organic brands out there. And Gene ran Cascadian for quite a long time, I think almost 30 years. And then it was eventually sold to General Mills. And Gene then went to work for General Mills. And he said that he was astonished when he saw the standards of cleanliness and sort of the hewing to the organic mission that General Mills had. Because he said that in his days of running Cascadian, he would make every possible effort to ensure that when he was harvesting organic crops, that the combines and the other equipment that they were using had been thoroughly cleaned after they might have been used for conventional purposes prior to the organic harvest. He said that when he went to General Mills, they would literally take the combine apart piece by piece and clean it out to make sure there was not a single grain of conventional left in there. So to a certain extent, I think that the legal definitions out there help, the fear of lawsuits helps, and I feel pretty good about the standards that have been created by these big companies out there, including the retailers who have jumped on the bandwagon.
Joe, thanks very much for all this. Really interesting stuff. And welcome back to Baltimore.
Thank you, Dan. This has really been a pleasure for me.
Yeah, Joe Dobrow, his book, Natural Profits from Health Foods to Whole Foods, the publisher is Rodale. Joe spent some time here in Baltimore opening up Fresh Fields. Thanks for reminding us about that and that story and what came of Fresh Fields and Whole Foods after that. Thank you for your time, Joe.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. See you. And thanks, folks, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. We're going to take a little break here of 22 hours and come back and do it again. So thank you very much for tuning in. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.